Having started working in kitchens at the tender age of just 13, my guest today became the first British chef to be awarded a Michelin star for an Indian restaurant outside of London. He's a winner of Gordon Ramsay's F Word and the Great British Menu. He has a string of awards and accolades behind him. He's born and bred Brummy with Bangladeshi heritage, and if you haven't already guessed who it is, well, it could be the one and only Akhtar Islam. How are you, Akhtar?
On a lovely sunny Friday afternoon, I'm really good actually. Yeah, really good. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining me. Finally, I think I've been asking you to join me for about a year and a half.
Yeah, I think for my claim,
you're very hard to get.
Yeah, you know what it is. It's a lot of my friends say it, I'm probably one of the busiest people in hospitality, purely because I'm still just so hands on. I've not found a way to pull myself away from the day-to-day activities of the business and just almost
and quite rightly so.
Work on it. You know, I'm still very much in it, so it's always it's a tough balance trying to find a bit of time just to do
fun. Well, thank you for finally giving me your time.
No, you're welcome, and I thank you for your persistence, and I apologize for taking so long.
No, it's all good. I got you on finally, so it's all good. So you are third generation restaurateur in your family. You started working in your dad's restaurant, washing pots at only age 13. But talk to us about your earlier days and when you started cooking and who got you inspired in the kitchen.
I think it's, you know, as with most people, and I think a lot of chefs will say the same thing, it always starts off with their mother. I mean, I've got a few friends who'll say their mother inspired them because their mothers were such terrible cooks. So in order to survive, they had to learn how to cook. You know, thankfully, I come from a family. You know, my mother, she's, you know, a feeder in the best sense that you can get. You know, she, you know, every meal was a banquet, and you know, we really ate well as kids. You know, one thing that my parents always made sure that you know, food was, you know, an integral part of our lives, and I think they're very much part of, you know, the community that they come from as well. So that's something that certainly you know, influenced my opinions towards food and my understanding of food, and realizing actually how important it is, not just as a form of sustenance, but the role it actually plays in society and bringing families, friends, and people together. You know, absolute strangers can become best of friends over a meal. And I've seen that happen within my restaurant, events that I've done, where, you know, people have just been sat next to each other at different, you know, at a table, not knowing who they are. And then by the end of the meal, they're great friends. And then you see them at the restaurant some months afterwards where, you know, you see their friendship has flourished, and it all started off with a meal. So, you know, inspiration and my love of food, certainly that's something that cultivated by my mother. And without stressing the laboring the point again, she's an excellent cook. So it's always been, I glean everything that I gleaned from my mother, you know, I still use today. And I often will ask my mother for reference and for, you know, I'm trying to do something that I remember she cooked or ideas or influences that, you know, because we often cook at the restaurant stuff that necessary isn't in vogue now, or it's something that people just don't cook anymore, or process that they don't use anymore. And you know, I often speak to my mother about that and try and bring those influences back in and use them at the restaurant. So yeah, for sure, it started off with my mother.
And it's quite interesting because I know that you spent time with your grandparents as well, didn't you, at one point. Was there the same sort of cooking influences going on in that household as well?
Yeah, so it's my maternal grandparents that I lived with. So obviously that sort of tradition of food and that relationship with food is something that came from my grandmother to my mother and my grandfather. You know, he was an epicure, and he was very much he enjoyed a party, and he enjoyed having friends around. So, you know, and food was always part of it. So it's something that I'd say is part of the DNA of my lineage.
Mm. It's interesting that you went to live with your grandparents. How did that come about in the first place?
It's sort of like, you know, the French Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So the similar sort of situation to that. I got into some trouble. I was shipped down south to live with my grandparents. And I spent, you know, on and off, a good four and a half, five years in London. So living around Canary Wharf, Aldgate, and Romford. So a bit of time there as well. So just basically living with family down there, and it made sure that I stayed out of trouble. But it was, you know, it was in stretches. So I'd spend a few months in London, a few months in Birmingham, and it's just a lot of back and forth. But it meant I managed to, make it through my teens without getting into too much trouble.
Well, I actually live near Canary Wharf now, but at that time, it was a very, very different place. I mean, it's really developed a lot now since.
Yeah. So at that time, it was Canary Wharf was, you know, the works were in play. So, you know, you had one or two of the buildings up. But yeah, I mean, it's a long, long, long time back. And yeah, I mean, you go back there now. And
restaurant scene is quite nice in Canary Wharf.
It is. But my last time there, actually, I spent a bit of time in Canary Wharf. I was filming MasterChef, and the hotel that I was staying at was actually in Canary Wharf. And it was just after lockdown. And I guess very similar to this area, Brindley Place, where it's very much office based. It hadn't sort of come back, and I took a walk around in the evening. I was just ashamed to see all these places that should have been a hub of activity closed. And so, you know, I've not been back since. I was in London last week, but obviously I didn't get into that area. But yeah, you know, but you see all these places, and I just thought to myself how amazing it would have been if all these places were open, because I had a lonely night in Canary Wharf, and had an early night because there's nothing to do, so which is probably a good thing because I'm filming the morning after. But yeah, but you're right, it's changed so much.
You need your beauty sleep.
Yeah, I need that. I think I need a month in bed, I think. Basically food and sleep, I think. God, and I think I've done well. You know, the lines aren't quite visible yet, but my mate who's also my dentist, but as you know, most dentists these days, they do Botox and stuff like that. So it's constantly on my back. It's like, it's more about prevention. You should just you know, it's a friend, but should I be offended here? Like, you know? Yeah. But yeah, I've not gone down that route yet. But who knows? Next time we have an interview in a couple of years' time, if I can't move my face, you know what's happening.
I know exactly what's happening. Brilliant. So you left school at a very young age. How did you find working full time when you were so young?
You know what? I never found it as an issue. I, you know, for me, it was almost like, you know, schools I didn't get on with that for whatever reason. And as I've said to you before, it's like, you know, I really, really value education. You know, for someone without education, you know, you understand the value of it. And I certainly do. So by no stretch of the imagination am I saying it's okay to do what I did, but alas, that's my life, and that's basically my story. And now, at the age of 13, I got kicked out of school. I didn't have much appetite about going back into it. Obviously, much resistance from my parents, but I was one of those kids that's very hard to control. And thankfully, my son's not like that. So, but yeah, you know, they had no choice. And for me to find myself in a space where, you know, there are people three times your age or more. But I just felt comfortable in there because I was quite a bolshy kid. So I
still are.
Well, yeah, I guess, yeah. No, not so much kid, but yeah. Still
not kid,
yeah.
Not kid. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a rep for saying what I feel. But ultimately, you know, that transition, I actually found it more a space that I felt comfortable in, as in who I was. And, you know, people I built relationships back then, I still speak to now. Obviously, you know, they've all retired and so on and so forth. But, you know, I went in there, I think at the start, obviously a lot of people, you know, the kids, they didn't know how to react or how to work with it. But, you know, I put my head down and I worked really hard, and I've just worked really hard ever since, really. And going in at such a young age, I think, and because you know you have to work really hard, because people are obviously gonna find reasons to have issue with you. And so for me, I knew if I did my job really well and didn't give anyone any opportunity to say anything negative about me, I'd be okay. And that sort of like shaped my attitude towards work. And I believe, you know, you go into work and you work as hard as you can. Mm. And that's how it's always been. And yeah, and I fit in really well. And you know, it's a space I felt comfortable in. So I don't know, is the word flourish the word to use? I don't know, because obviously, you know, looking back at it now as a 13-year-old kid, you know, my son's 15 and I look at him now and I think, bloody hell, if he was to be in the environment that I was in, it'd break my heart. So it makes you realize what my parents were going through. But, you know, I was working from 3 in the afternoon to 4 a.m. because that's what Indian restaurants were back then in Birmingham. You know,
and was that at your dad's place?
Yeah, so it started off there. Yeah. And but that was just basically the scene in Birmingham. There's, you know, that's just how it was. And it was general norm. So, you know, and through that, you develop a completely different, I guess, mindset. I grew up a lot quicker because the people around me were all adults. I wasn't really necessarily with people my age. So you become your environment, right? And those you associate with. Now, these people are spending close to 80 hours a week with. So that is going to rub off on me, and it did. And you know, it meant that I grew up a lot quicker. And I don't really have a childhood. That's the best way to put it. Or especially, you know, I didn't enjoy my teenage years, but it's probably a good thing.
Yeah. Oh, well, so by sounds of it, I mean, you got into a lot of trouble when you were young anyway, and you got moved around a lot. So I guess for you, that was probably the best thing that could have happened, was to just grow up really quickly, because otherwise maybe it was just a troubled life as a child, or just grow up and be who you are today.
I'll be honest with you, it is a massive blessing. And I think, you know, looking back at it, my parents now look at it and think, yeah, it was. And at the time, obviously, it broke their hearts. But the reality of the situation is I grew up in a time where, and, you know, bear in mind, I grew up in inner city Birmingham in a suburb or an area called Ashton. And you know, it's a deprived area, and it still to this day is. But I grew up in the time where heroin became a big problem. And, you know, the people I was associating with, and, you know, we're talking an entire generation of people from that area, they fell victim to heroin. Mm. And quite in a weird way, you know, I don't know why, but I bumped into someone who was involved in that situation and thankfully has sorted his life out. And I was shopping and I bumped into him, and we all had a bit of a reunion. So there's about 20 of us, people I've not seen since I was about 16. Mm. And, you know, a lot of them had fallen victim and they found their way out. But then amongst our peer group at that time, you know, a lot of them sadly passed away because of their addiction to drugs. And, you know, some of them have been, you know, those who've been able to see themselves through it and come out the other end and, you know, be a productive member of society and add value to their family and everything else, and just make it through, should I say. You know, that it was lovely meeting up with them, but there's so many from that group who still to this day they've got issues. They're either still on it or they're on methadone, and that could have been me.
Yeah,
because that was my peer group. These are the people that I, you know, they're my friends. And you know, when you're young, you know, your friends are your life. You know, they're in a funny way, they're closer to you than your family are. It's just how kids are, you know. And that could have been me. So by, you know, my parents moving down to London, by me then also deciding to work full time in an environment that basically took every waking hour of your day, I never had the free time to get involved with everything or follow that journey that they were on and that path that they were on. Because that could have led me to a scary place. And, you know, so I am very thankful for it. I mean, it was hard labor, but it's given me some good lessons, and it's, you know, it's served me well.
And Akhtar, at that time, did you know that you wanted to be a chef? Did you know that, or was it just well, you know, dad owns a restaurant, I'm just going to work there because that's what I know, and then see what happens? Did you feel like, you know, this is what I actually want to do? Or was it just something you got pulled into?
I think I always knew I enjoyed cooking, because I used to cook with my mother from, I remember my earliest memory is 6-7 years old.
Mm.
Simple stuff like, you know, washing rice and stuff. And I remember, I still have vivid images of watching the grains of rice pass through your fingers, as, you know, that ritual of washing rice. And, you know, I still remember that. And so I always knew I enjoyed cooking, because I also enjoyed basically the kudos, you know, my mother got and the respect she got from the community, because she was a very good cook. And, you know, when friends, family would come around, and, you know, basically, you know, just to see the reaction on people's face when they're eating something, it's gratification. So, you know, it fed, you know, we've all got an ego. Some people's ego ruled, and I think in the early part of my life, my ego did rule me. So that, I knew that would feed that. So that was my relationship with cooking. So I knew I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the showmanship of it. So did I want to do it for 80, 90 hours a week, every week for the next 30 years or 28 years? Did I make that decision then? No, I didn't.
Yeah.
But I knew hospitality is something that I would probably go into, purely because, you know, it was a family business, like, you know, something that we've carried on for 3 generations. And I thought,
it felt natural.
Yeah, I felt comfortable in that space, but
yeah.
I couldn't tell you if I ever made that conscious decision, you know, so this is what I want to do. I think it just became me. And that is that. And so if you ask my son, they say, you know, what's your dad like, or what, tell me about your dad, his only response is he cooks. That's it, because that's all I do.
So you had experience in different curry houses. You worked in an Italian restaurant as well. But at just age 21, that's pretty young, you decided to open up Karma, which took over your dad's place. How did that decision come about, and what was it that made you just say, yeah, I'm going to open my own place, and yeah, it's going to be dad's restaurant? And how did that work for you guys, even as a family?
Well, one of the reasons why I stopped working with my father and in that space is because his background, he worked in central Birmingham, so city centre Birmingham curry restaurants. That's how he learned his trade. So these were always situated around nightclubs and stuff like that. So they ran it like that. So the restaurant was open till stupid hours in the morning. There was always a fight on the weekends. You know, you'd get groups of lads coming in, trashing the place. Sometimes groups of girls as well, you know, just trashing the place. And they just put up with it. And they'd get naan bread thrown at them. And you'd see, like, casual racism. It was sort of language and the sort of conversations today, you know, no one would have in public, whereas that was just how they were treated. And, you know, I thought to myself, that's not the sort of space and that's not the sort of life I want. If I'm going to be in this industry, I don't want that. And I remember once when my father introduced me to a guest, you know, he said, my duty was to serve them. And I thought to myself, well, that's making me no better than a slave. And I thought, as much as I love hospitality and I love what I knew of the industry at that point, did I want to see my career through in an environment like that, to be treated like that and to have to work like that in a space like that? And I said no. So that's why I moved away from Indian restaurants, because that was part and parcel of the Indian restaurant experience. And that's just how it was.
It's also a bit of a cultural thing, isn't it? To, you know, to serve and to be kind of, you know, there for your guests, like, you know, hand on foot.
I think they've got this, I don't know where it came from, but, you know, remember back in the day, they'd all be dressed up like butlers for whatever reason. And I think that's what it was. They're, you know, for $3.95 or for, you know, fiver a curry and rice and bread, you've got your own bloody butler. And I thought to myself, it's just bullshit, you know, and I don't know where they got that from. Yes, you know, I think, you know, within the Asian community, you know, hospitality is part and part of the culture, you know. at home, that's I get it, but you certainly don't expect to be treated like that at home. You certainly won't be treated like that by at home. You know, even if you've got guests you've got disagreements with, that's still done in a sort of, there's a process for it, and there's a way of doing it. Whereas at an Indian restaurant, they just got treated like absolute shit. And I thought to myself, that's not the industry I want to be part of. Yes, I want to be part of hospitality, but that's not what I want. So that's when I started working outside of Indian food, and I worked for this place called. And I just saw how different people were from the guests, how the guests conducted themselves to how, you know, the service team and the chefs and everyone, you know, the interaction was just completely different. I thought, yeah, this is what I want. I want to be treated with respect. I want to come to work, be treated with respect. I don't want someone to throw food at me and make racist slurs and laugh about it and me just be okay. That's not it. And that basically showed me a different way of, you know, took me out of that environment that I knew and put me in a space that I thought, you know what, this is what I love, this is what I enjoy. And the other great thing about that space that I went to is the creativity, because, as you know, Indian restaurants probably went through a phase where about 30 years where the menu did not change. And when it has started to change, some disasters have come out of it. But, you know, the model stayed exactly the same, right? And whereas I'm now in a restaurant where, you know, menu's changing daily, you know, the produce that's coming in is just incredible. And you know, for me, it just felt amazing. You know, I'd my eyes had been opened, and I'd found what I thought never existed because of the environment I was from. And so working with them there and sort of understanding the mantra and how they approached everything, and realizing how easy it is to transfer that into other spaces and other cuisines. It's, you know, and we're not talking fusion. It's a case of just taking that thought process and that approach. And, you know, there's a guy there called Bertie, who's their exec chef. You know, from him I learned, you know, ingredients, like, you know, why ingredients are so important. You just don't buy whatever's in the market. You know, there's tomatoes and then there's tomatoes, and you know, there's oil and, you know, there's olive oil and then there's olive oil, you know, and you know, the importance and the value of good ingredients and what that does for you. That's where I learned about that. And basically after about 18 months or so working with them, and sadly their relationship with Birmingham wasn't very good, because at that point Brummies didn't really get what real Italian food is actually about. You know, what we knew of Italian food back then was Pizza Hut, you know, and they were doing, you know, proper trad, you know, Italian food, like, you know, which almost felt alien for people in Birmingham, because, you know, back then our carbonaras were still creamy with loads of cream, loads of bacon. You know, it wasn't right. You know, our pizzas were all deep pan. You know, what they were doing was just too far ahead for Birmingham. Thankfully, it's caught up now. So they were almost, yeah, well, the decision had come, but they were going to leave the city as well, because they just couldn't be bothered anymore.
So you wanted to bring the ethos that you learned over there back into your own family business.
Well, yeah. So what happened to Bertie said, look, as these discussions became more and more open, he said, look, obviously what you can do though is go back to the food that you know, and, you know, that food that you grew up with, and take this approach and apply it there. And I thought to myself, yeah, I could do that. Obviously, my business plan was in my head. It just went, you know, it just made sense in my head. There's no figures or anything on it. So those were the days where you could basically walk into a bank and get a loan, right? I mean,
but you didn't need that because you already had your dad's place. Is that right? You didn't need a loan, did you?
No, I didn't need a loan, because obviously I had to strip it back and start again.
Okay.
So I went into a bank, and I went into two banks actually, and pulled out, you know, quite a sizable amount in loan.
Awesome. Gone are the days. Can't do that anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, and basically I said to my mum, look, I've got the money. I need you to give me the space, and I'm going to turn it around, and I'm going to take it from where it is now with all its, you know, and it wasn't doing too well, to be honest with you. So it's not like there was a massive gamble for them. And I said to my mum, if it doesn't work, you can take your restaurant back, carry on doing whatever you're doing, and at least you've had a little bit of a refurb, and I'll walk the earth again.
And they had nothing to lose, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it took a lot of convincing for my father. My mum was on board straight away.
Why was your dad hesitant?
It's classic archetypal, you know, South Asian father. You know, I know best. You know, I've been in the industry for blah, blah, blah. What do you know? It's my business, this and the other. And you know, it was a struggle. So everything I was doing, like, you know, taking a 7-cover restaurant, turning it into a 40-cover restaurant, in his brain, just
the numbers don't work.
No, it's like, you know, you're supposed to increase capacity.
Yeah.
And I was going totally the other way. Instead of opening till 4 in the morning, I was done at 11. You know, last orders were 10, and that's it. You know, and that didn't make sense because it's thinking, oh, we're losing 5 hours trading time a day. The covers, what's this guy doing? He's got rid of all the flock wallpaper. You know, the look that I went for, it almost looked like a really nice art gallery. It's just white, with lovely like artwork on the walls, and you know, the colors were built around basically chocolates and cream. So it had it was very classy and small, intimate dining room. And it just did not work for him. So I said to him, all your furniture and stuff that you've got now, just put it in storage. If it doesn't work, you can just plonk it back in. I'll put your wallpaper on and we can forget it ever happened. And obviously I opened up, there was a massive buzz about it. And this was the days before social media or anything like that. You know, buzz was very much word of mouth. And you know, before you know it, we had waiting lists for weekends for months ahead, and which was unheard of for an Indian restaurant. In Birmingham at that time, and you know, we were busy every night, and the food was it's a transition from mainstream curry to sort of like it's nowhere near where I am now, but it's a transition. It's just moved, so everything was fresh. You know, if something was called a jalfrezi, it was cooked as a jalfrezi should be, as it would be traditionally done, as opposed to, you know, the curry house model, your one pot,
a shortcut version. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the menu was also dime sized, and it worked. It worked really well. So for the guests, the consumer, it wasn't too far away from what they knew and understood, but they knew they were at the start of the journey. But what I guess, you know, I did that for about 2 years, and I found constant a pullback from my father. It's something that I've had to deal with throughout my whole career, actually, where you've got people who are there who don't necessarily understand what's going on, and because they don't understand what's going on, it makes them feel insecure, which then makes them put barriers, even though they can see it's good for them, because, you know, the business has never made as much money as it was making in that period that I was there. And in the end, it just became too much for me. And I thought to myself, I've proven the point. I know the journey I'm on has merit. So I said to my father, rather than fighting with you every day about things, you can have the restaurant back. I've said it for you. It's been running for 2 years. Follow this process and you'll be fine. You know, and good luck with it. And at that point, obviously I end up joining Lausanne.
So just a pause there for a second. So does your dad still run Karma then? Does he
still there, but it's you know, he's got his old guests, you know, and it's more like a hobby for him now.
Okay.
You know, the guys who work there, they've all been working together forever, and they just go into something to do.
Okay. All right. So you moved on to Lausanne Group, as you mentioned, with Jabbar Khan. It's very public that relationship went sour. But talk to us about that time, how the relationship started, what you were doing with them. Were you just in as a chef, a partner? How was that relationship? And what are the lessons that you learned from that experience?
So how it came about is I'd known Gavin since I was about 16, so I've known him for quite a few years, 16, 17. And so whilst I was setting up Karma, he was setting up Lasan. And whilst Karma was doing, you know, just doing incredible things, Lasan was really struggling because, I'll be honest with you, they didn't really know what they were doing, and the food was terrible as well. And I remember one of the Saturday nights walking in after I finished off with Karma, went over to Lasan. I saw Jabba just there with his hands in his head in his hands and saying, you know, I need to get, help me get out of this nightmare. And at that point, you know, we obviously I'd been helping him. So when I used to go and pick up my produce, I'd go and pick up produce for him as well. So, you know, as a friend, I was doing my bit for him, but at that point I wasn't involved. And then when I made that decision to leave my father, I said to Jabba, all right, look, okay, because he was always asking for my help, asking for advice, you know, with food and so on and so forth. So I said, look, you know, get me out of this nightmare. All right, so let's get this place to a saleable state, and then you can sell it and you can get out, and which is what was agreed. I put a bit of money into it to help with a bit of a refurb to help with space. I obviously went on as a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And to basically help get it to that stage where, you know, we can get it and it's got some market value, so we can sell it. But in doing that, and in doing that change and the transition, so I went there, and by getting the food right and getting the food to match customers' expectations, so, you know, it made sense for the guests, you know, as opposed to people just trying it and not being happy with that and never coming back. You know, we got to a stage where we had regular custom, the business had, you know, it had a footing, now it was stable. And at that stage, it was a case of decision, all right, well, now the business is stable, it's got a balance sheet, it's got income, it's probably time to sell it. But then the decision was made, because obviously that was Jabba's only form of income, to hold on to it and see what else can happen. So at that point, I sort of left. I left the Lasan. So I'd been there about 2 years, and I at that point I thought I'd done my bit. Don't really want to work in this space. So I left for a few years, and then in 2009, because where I left it, and by 2009 it hadn't actually moved forward in any way whatsoever. Even though I was still there on weekends, giving them a push, helping them out when staff were leaving, helping them with recruitment. I was still there, but I wasn't involved on a day-to-day basis because I just didn't want that. And then in 2009, it was a similar sort of situation. All right, obviously everything's gone to pots again. Help us out, sort of thing. And I ended up going back in. And then obviously the whole F-word thing happened. So how the whole F-word thing happens, I was doing a little gig with Luke from Simpsons in Birmingham. I don't know if you know him. And it was for Mumsnet, and we had to do basically mission star baby food, and we had to make three items.
Nice.
And the judging panel were a bunch of babies and their mums, really, and, you know, and the babies, you know, they had the last word. So we're doing that. It was a great day of fun, and, you know, a little fun competition as well. So I won that, and it was being run by McCann Erickson. I don't know if you know the PR agency, and the young lady called Sophie there, and she just obviously saw something in me, and she said, you know, you need to do this, you know, and I sort of backed it off. But yeah, moving back onto the whole Lasan thing, so I went back in, I did this thing at Mumsnet, met Sophie convinced me to do the F word, I met Tony, who was the researcher for the F word at the time, and it was incredible actually, because he was just starting his career at that point. And I recently worked with him on MasterChef, where right. He's now actually a director. And I thought it's incredible just, you know, how we both started our careers together.
And where you are now, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's great. So I had a meeting with him, and basically they'd made the decision that they'd actually decided on two restaurants already. So obviously Curry Corner, the very traditional, you know, mother, father, daughter, family business in Cheltenham. You probably don't remember it, but that's one. And there was another restaurant that they picked, which was supposed to be the more avant-garde Indian restaurant, because they were pitting tradition against, you know, contemporary. And, you know, these guys were cooking crocodile and ostrich and this, that, and the other. Absolute clowns, in my opinion. But anyway, they'd made their decision. But after Tony met me, he was just so, I don't know, just enthused. He, you know, they went back and they actually changed. And they dropped the other company, the other restaurant, and they had me on.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the rest is history, you know. Went on there and I didn't expect
it. It changed everything for you. It put you on the map, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It changed absolutely everything. Because before then, obviously, I'd enjoyed a bit of notoriety in and around Birmingham, you know, and that's fine. But that put you in front of the nation, you know, several million people every Friday night. And the show ran for, I think, nearly 4 months or something like that, 4 or 5 months.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a long old slog. But yeah, that changed everything. Obviously, went there, won the first round. As soon as we won that, the restaurant was fully booked for months ahead. And then I just kept winning, like kept going through every process. And I'm thinking, fuck, you know, when's it going to stop? But I just kept winning all the way through. And, you know, there was one bit where I think a lot of people still take the piss out of me for now. But I actually broke down on camera because I'm quite not a tough cookie, but I'm not really an emotional person. And I just couldn't stop fucking crying because I was just so emotional because the journey to that point was just so tough because the one prior to that, and I thought I'd just lost it because the one prior to that, you know, was at the restaurant and anything that involved the restaurant was just an absolute disaster because, you know, I'd just come back and this is happening. You know, I've not had the time to really retrain all these guys and we're trying to do something which really wasn't what we did at the restaurant. You know, at that point, Lausanne was just microwave, microwave, microwave. You know, just ping everything out. And then we're doing this program where everything's built around live cooking and I've come back in and, you know, instead of having that time to slowly grow into that, I came back in a couple of months later, we're on TV and the restaurant fully booked every day and we're having to cook a completely different way or they're having to cook a completely different way than they used to. So obviously when the cameras were at the restaurant, it was a shambles. And I just competed and cooked against Ernesto. And I thought, I just broke down. I thought, you know, this is it, you know. And obviously I won that stage as well, but I just could not stop crying. So every stage. So obviously on the show itself, you know, in the end I won because of basically how I cooked. And there was a lot of criticism about the actual show because it's supposed to be best restaurant. Everyone wanted this restaurant called Santa Maria to win because Ernesto, who I became extremely good friends with, but because they had a beautiful feel about their restaurant. And when all the F-word guests arrived at the restaurant, they all absolutely loved it. They were treated beautifully. And their experience was incredible in comparison to the experience at Lausanne. It was horrendous. So obviously I ended up winning the entire series and, you know, there's a lot of, not controversy, but there's a lot of blowback from the public, like discussions within the whole production team about, you know, whether...
Because it is about the restaurant and less about you, right? So you can understand that, but...
Yeah, but Gordon...
you were a better chef.
You know, Gordon stood strong and is like, I don't care really. And I, you know, and obviously I ended up winning it. And and you know, since
then, what happened to Lausanne after that then? So
it just went nuts. You know, we're fully booked for about a year ahead. And that
and
just
your
led,
relationship with them?
Well, I was still there, but at that point my relationship was I was working 90-100 hours a week. I was just working and you know, there were times where I'd sleep on the restaurant couch because I'd just been, I remember one of the, just before Valentine's, I'd just finished prepping for Valentine's Day at 4 a.m, knowing that I've got to be back in a few hours' time. I just fell asleep on the couch. And then, you know, that's basically what became my life for about 5 years because
wow.
In that process, you know, I took a, you know, we start building other restaurants, we start opening other restaurants. So I became really good friends with Ernesto from the Argentine restaurant, spent a bit of time with him, learned about that, spent some time in Argentina. I thought, you know what, this is what Birmingham needs. So I opened that. So all I was doing is basically working all the restaurants and opening series of restaurants. So, you know, in 2009, when I went back in, you know, the turnover for the group was 400K. By 2014, 2015, it was nearly 9 million.
Amazing. So
you can imagine. And it was all built on. But in that process, obviously, you know, I nearly killed myself doing it, because, you know, there was a time my doctor had me on a heart rate monitor because I fainted at work because I just got so pissed off. Yeah. And, you know, and I had to do a lot of work to keep myself off medication. And obviously in that period as well, I'd missed out on my son growing up as well. So, yeah, it became really difficult. But
that's a lot of sacrifice there.
Yeah, I mean, I just look back at it now and I think, bloody hell, you know, why? But then you think, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, the journey must continue. But the problem that I found is a similar situation that I had with my father. The people that I was involved in, so it's just me and then a family. So I own 35% of the business and they own the rest of it. And like Gordon said to me, there's only so long you can drag these people along with you before you burn out or you drop dead.
Mm-hmm.
So they either need to start rowing in the same direction as you, or you need to get out of this boat. And, you know, it's funny that I kept it going for so long, but it was a similar situation to basically my father, where we've got a business where they have very little understanding of the space that you're in, the environment, you know. You know, fine dining, for example, it's not just a way of cooking. It's an entire ethos. It's how you live your life as a business, you know. And this is not, you know, their background. Curry. I remember having conversations where it's like, you know, when we do menu development, it's like, well, can you not just make it a curry, but like a curry, but not a curry, but like a curry? And to this day, I still haven't worked out what that fucking means. Basically, what it means is. Yeah. We're comfortable with curry. Can you make it curry? So it's a product we can understand. So, you know, we're comfortable with it. Not accepting the fact that the guests that are coming to the restaurant weren't coming for curry. And this battle carried on for years, even though they were enjoying the fruits of my labor. And I remember we had a discussion where my business partner, Jabba, at the time, he said to me that nobody wants your fancy plate to shit.
Okay.
So at that point, I thought, okay, fair enough. You know, nobody wants my fancy place to shit. So I said, look, I'll present my stuff to you. You guys make the decision what you want to do, you, your family, whatever. You decide, and then you can work with the team and they can deliver that. Because at that point, I was busy with the Argentine restaurant developing that. So I said, you guys can do that. So I put my ideas forward, present my dishes. So there you go, guys. You guys do whatever. And it all invariably ended up as shit. But what happens, and what made that like total decision for me to say this is not me is I'd get guests who obviously see me on TV doing stuff, coming to the restaurant, and because on the restaurant, on the website, it had images of my work, but what was actually being delivered was basically the other end of the spectrum. And, you know, that sense of disappointment of these people coming with so much expectation and leaving so disappointed. And I don't know if you know Steve Groves. He used to work for...
Yeah.
So Steve, I've known him for years. His wife's a very good friend of mine as well. And he came up for dinner. No, it was actually lunch. And I wasn't cooking then. I was at Fiesta del Sado. And Alicia and Steve, you know, after they had their meal, about 2 days later, they sent me a message saying, you know, just some honest feedback. And Alicia's words were, this isn't your food. And for me, it was that conversation was the realization that my name was being used to sell a lie to a degree. And at that point, the decision was made that we needed to part company. Mm. And I needed to basically get away from that business and those people. And And that was it for me. It cemented it for me. And that was it. And that at that point, I'd made my my intentions very clear that I will be parting company. And I'm going to obviously pursue my own dreams. And I think
best thing you ever did.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Because like I say, for me, it felt like freedom. I wake up every day, I feel like a free man. Whereas back then, you were shackled. And I was shackled. And so were, everyone in the team. But that entire business was built on exploitation, whether it be the people involved or the guests. Because it didn't sit too well with me at all. Whereas now, that day I made that decision is probably the first time I had a good night's sleep in nearly a decade. And I had a year out and just cleared my head. I traveled a bit. And I found myself again.
Yeah. It's incredible that you put up with it for such a long time. That I'm just amazed that you just, you just kind of hung on.
You do it because you think, we've been friends since we were 16.
Yeah.
And for me,
it's more about friendship.
Yeah, I value friendship over money. I've come from a background where, money wasn't plentiful, but it wasn't, it wasn't like, the be all and end all of everything. We got by as long as we got great food on our table every day, three times a day. We're happy. And, money wasn't my thing. It's always about friendship. And to be fair, the money, in that business, it wasn't there because, it was basically, it was finding its way in other directions. But that's also what led to me leaving anyway. It was just so nice to wake up in the morning thinking, I just don't have to deal with this bullshit anymore. And, imagine being in a position for the first time in nearly 10 years where you can do whatever you fucking want. Like, it's an incredible feeling, actually. It's and I know there are others this will resonate with, but, it is an incredible feeling to come out. And I felt like, I've been let free from prison or something like that, or you could have been, it was a very abusive relationship, and there was a lot of, because that family, they had issues, or they were in a space that they didn't understand. And obviously, the business was just fully hinged on me. They'd have concerted efforts to try and chip away at your self-worth, really. And it was a conscious effort to constantly make you question your value and value as a person or in your art or your thoughts. It was very belittling. And whereas now it's like, I can be comfortable in my thoughts. I can say, do whatever I want. And it's great. I've got no one to answer to. And I look after all my team, and my team are very happy. And we're all like a family. And we've got a beautiful environment to work in, and if we need a bit of equipment for the kitchen, we don't have to sit there and beg for it. I had my kitchen 2 years later, throughout lockdown. I had a chat with Neil and a couple of the other guys and said, I don't like this kitchen anymore. I think we cook differently now, and I they thought I was just going to make a few changes in the kitchen or add some equipment. And then we had a chat on Friday. On Monday, they came in, and I'd been in over the weekend and start basically ripping things up out and stripping out. So it forced me to do it.
Yeah.
And then they realized it's a wholesale change, and we stripped the entire thing out, spent another $500,000 on a brand new kitchen.
Wow.
And, okay. But, coming from an environment where we had to beg for spoons.
Yeah.
To just wake up on a Friday and then by Saturday morning start ripping it out, and by Monday commission a new kitchen.
Yeah.
It's
really it's very inspirational conversation, because it's a common thread that business relationships do go sour. And I think it's great for people to hear this, that it gives them the courage to know that it's okay if you break free. And you know, you've got that, you've just got that confidence to move on and move forward and do your own thing. It's just really great to hear where you are now from that, from all that.
It is important because I think those in, and I talk to a lot of my friends who've followed the same journey, have been through the similar situation. Often seems to be chefs or something, I don't know why. But then I mean, I know some friends about some professionals in a similar sort of situation. But the thing is, it's like there is like, you know, almost like the other party, they're always, it's always a similar sort of situation where you're made to feel you can't do anything without them. Or, you know, your contribution is minimal and you're lucky to have them. But the reality of the situation is, especially in my position as a chef, you know, I do everything they do and I do everything I do. So all these years, it made me question, well, what were you doing? Because you didn't know the product, you didn't know the business, you didn't really know the business. But when you sat in front of your computer pretending to be important, what is it that you're doing? Because I've got three businesses that I run. They all run fine. I still work in my kitchens. Why do I need you and your brother and your nephew and this and that? What were four or five of you doing? Because I know I was cooking. And I was looking after all the suppliers, and I was doing the HR, and I was looking after all the properties. So what is it that you guys are doing? So what is it that, you see? So it's that thing. So, that process is quite common where you will find people do that to people in order to make themselves feel more secure. And it's that thing. You one day you wake up and you realize, and for me, the realization came from having a chat with Atul.
Mm-hmm. Atul Kocher.
Yeah, he's like one of my best mates, and he's been
one of the nicest people in the industry.
Oh, fucking, I was an angel. I absolutely love him. I've got so much respect for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're right. He's just one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. But he's the one who, because obviously he went through a similar situation that I did, and he said to me, it's like, get the fuck out of there. You know, he very rarely swears. Mm. It's quite funny when he swears.
I don't think I've ever heard him swear.
Yeah, no, he very rarely does, but when he does swear, he's like, you wake up.
You know he means it.
He's serious, yeah. You know, and it's like, get the fuck out. Then another mate of mine, Nigel Howarth, you probably know as well. He was like, you need to get out. And that was it.
Self-belief, wasn't it? You just needed, I guess you needed that self-belief to just take the step and do it.
Yeah, and like I say, Atul was instrumental in that, and Nigel, but Atul very much so. You know, he made me realize, like, man, you can do it, and you deserve it. And you know, it's always as bullshit and as confident as anyone is. It's always the transition into the unknown. It's always quite scary.
Always,
as bad as your situation may be. Sometimes it's, better the devil you know, right? I didn't come out with that term. It's there for a reason. And so it's great to have friends like that who you know.
Who've got your back.
Yeah. You know, they're not just blowing hot air up your ass. They're serious. You know, and if what was going through your head was wrong, they'd also be honest with you and say no. So it's great to, I'll be honest with you, I'm so thankful to have friends like that.
So 2017, you left Lausanne Group and opened Ophim in 2018. You got your first start in 2019, which is amazing. Congratulations on even retaining it, because it's, as hard to keep it. So talk to us about the kind of makings of Ophim and where the concept came from. How long had you been planning it before? I mean, is this like something you had planned for years to like open your own restaurant and design it the way you want to, all of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so it started out when I was about 16.
Okay.
So 16 or 17. So I worked for, you may have heard of them. They were very big back in the 90s, an Indian restaurant called Shimla Pinks in Birmingham.
Yeah.
And they were at that point, like at the forefront of what Indian restaurants could be. And, I thought, bloody hell, one day it'd be lovely to have somewhere like this. And, you know, that thought process starts, and me and a couple of friends, you know, we all used to work together. We all had that same sort of chat, and I'm the only one out of those that's still in hospitality. And, you know, and it was at that point, that's when I thought of the name. And, you know, the branding obviously developed over the years, but I knew what I was going to call it, because, you know, I knew the feeling that I wanted. It was all about, you know, alluring and intoxicating and you know, it's all about sensory feedback and so on and so forth. So I thought, you know, I knew what the name was going to be. And then I read, a few years later, I read a book, it's like a courtly manuscript called The Nimatnama, which is Sultan of Mandu, circa 1300s. Mm-hmm. And he was an epicure, and a third of that is basically dedicated to recipes. And it was just incredible, the recipes that the chefs were working with back then and how forward thinking they were. And, you know, something about him, he seemed to enjoy life, you know, and something that he enjoyed was open as well. So it was, you know, built off that. So the name came together. That's when the name came about. And then obviously what we cook there develops every day. I mean, what we were cooking 4 years ago when we first opened to what we're cooking today is completely different. So the process of the development of all the food that we serve is a constant journey. And in 5 years' time, it will be very different to what we're doing today, because that's just me and my team growing and me and my team evolving. But the ethos behind the food, that was set in stone 20 years ago when I opened Karma. You know, I knew the journey that I was on, and that's the journey that I was going to go with. And then with regards to the space, it's something that I did back then with Karma. It's like, well, it's an Indian or a restaurant that serves food with an Indian influence or celebrating Indian culinary heritage. Does it have to look like the Taj Mahal? No, it doesn't. That's what I did 20 years ago. The same thing that I did with Ofim. You know, Ofim was built around my love of Birmingham, and, you know, it's my home. So that's
where does the name come from? Where does the name Ofim come from?
So Ofim, it came from, it's a play on the word opium. So the Hindi word is afim. If you so the Hindi word for opium is afim. So it's softening that, and so it's a combination of the syllables from the Indian pronunciation, okay, and then the OP from the English word for opium.
So it's, do you speak Hindi?
No, I mean, I can understand it, and even like little bits of I've worked over the years with a lot of people from, you know, Tamil Nadu, and so, you know, a little bit of Telugu and stuff. I can understand it, but I can't really speak it. Obviously, I know a few words here and there, but I'm only fluent in English. Okay. I can't even speak Bengali.
Okay.
So that's where the name opium
came from. And what about the design of it? Because it is a stunning, stunning space. I love what you've done with it. Is that your own input in terms of the design, or did you get a designer?
No, so the designers I work with, they basically put my ideas onto paper because I can't use CAD. So we often joke about it, and they're great. The girls are Kendall. I've got a fantastic relationship with her. So once you learn CAD, you won't need us anymore. Because for me, you know, all my restaurants have a totally unique feel about them. But you know, they're my restaurants because just the way the materials are used and the combination of materials. So with regards to Ofim, obviously, Birmingham was known as it was a grey space, wasn't it? Because of all the concrete everywhere.
Yeah.
Right? And that's a sort of architectural that development went through from 60s, you know, till probably the late 80s. Everything was still in that shit grey concrete. So I thought, well, we're in Birmingham, and it's very much part of who we are, that grey concrete. That's why we've got that it's a Venetian pasta, but it's very, very tactile, very rough, very unfinished, but it's got a really nice matte tone to it. So that's where the grey came from. And then you see the use of like metals in the artwork and stuff like that, because obviously we're part of the jewelry quarter. So the jewelry quarter is somewhere I lived since my early 20s. So it's almost like a nod to that. So basically, everything that we have in that space, it's built around my relationship with Birmingham.
Fantastic.
And the representation of Birmingham. Because we were actually supposed to do, the restaurant was supposed to be in Mayfair.
Really?
And yeah. And, you know, very far down the line in conversations. And then it was a last minute decision where I looked at my son and I thought, I've not seen you grow. You know, I've missed most of your childhood. If I'm in London, I'll miss your teen years as well.
Right.
So that's the only thing that pulled me back and made me set up in Birmingham.
Oh, wow.
So the property, everything, you know, was identified. It's very far down the line.
Wow. And what do you think in the future? Do you think that it's a possibility to come down into London at some point?
You know, you like to say never, right? But, you know, I am a Brummie lad. So, you know, my life is hinged around here. You know, I invest heavily in the city. It's been very much part of, you know, my life.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, I do often have conversations with operators in London, like, would you consider coming out? Would you consider taking the space, you know, and working with, you know, I'm sure you've worked, spoken to a lot of chefs who are doing a lot of collabs or residencies and management contracts. So these are conversations that we always have, you know. There may be one that really takes my fancy and takes me further than a conversation. But right now, you know, my attitude is, you know, write whatever's happening out, because we don't know where it's going, and then, you know, continue, you know, like, charity starts at home, right? So you've got to look after your own, you've got to look after the city, you know, the investment in the city, and look after the people of the city, and do that right, do that justice, and then when you have capacity, then look elsewhere. So right now, as much as it'd be great to do, and I think it'd be a lot of fun to do, is it a serious consideration? But like I say, you never know.
You never know. But I'm sure we'd love to see you in London. It would be really, really exciting. So let's talk about your current menu out of Fume and what you're delivering there. So your tasting menu, you've put down the regions actually that a particular dish has taken inspiration from. So for example, you've got like Andhra Pradesh, Nepal, Kerala, Mumbai, Bengal. So not only do we have a description of the dish, but also a geographical association with it almost. You're taking us on a culinary tour.
See, one of the things with me is like Indian food, what we want to do with Afima, what, you know, my approach to Indian food is, it's not just looking at a particular, because I wasn't born and brought up in India, so I've got no bias, you know, I'm not biased to any particular type of cuisine, because I've not been brought up with, so everything is as weird and as wonderful as everything else, you know. Absolutely love food from every region, and for us, it's about celebrating all of those cultures, and not only looking at it in contemporary times and what's being cooked in India today, let's start looking at the development of that particular style of cuisine. Let's go as far back as our resources allow us to, and see and explore and then celebrate that process. And that's what our theme's about. So none of our menus will ever be based around one particular region. It will always have nods, and it's always designed with what ingredients we're working with as well. Mm-hmm. And it's bring out the best in that, and that's basically it. So I think for us, the key points is celebrating British ingredients, you know, the best of our country and what we're producing today, and then combining that with as many cultures as we can celebrate and highlight and bring to the forefront. Because something that's important for me with Indian food is the fact that it's just known as Indian food.
Yeah.
But there's so much to it.
Yeah.
So many different cultures.
Yeah.
Like, it's a massive landmass, you know, and there's so much diversity in that. To put it under a blanket of Indian food, I feel it's a disservice, and I feel it's disrespectful. So for me, it's important that when people eat a particular dish, they understand where it's from, we'll get an idea of where it's from. The front of house team will give more in-depth information, and the chefs who we serve our food. But it's important that they know that as well. And that's why they also walk away understanding the diversity that there is in Indian food and how much there is that they will still have to learn about it. You know, because you've been to a curry house for 20 years and you've been going there every Friday, doesn't mean you know Indian food. You don't.
Yeah, 100%. And how much time did you spend in India?
Oh, God, we used to, every year we'd go over, we'd spend about three to four weeks.
Visiting all the different regions, yeah, and just trying to cover as much as you could, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, air miles wise, carbon footprint wise, is fucking horrendous. You spend 2 or 3 days in a particular area, get on a plane, fly over 2 or 3 days somewhere else, and it was just like,
and how, by the how end does of it work? Do you decide, right, I'm going to go to Gujarat and then seek out the chef and then contact them and then spend some time with them? How does it work?
No, we had a Mr. Fixer out there.
Oh, you did, Mr. Fixer.
Yeah, so he'd basically line everything up for us. So these are the people you need to look at when you go there. This is what I think you should try, blah, blah, blah. And so it was, the itinerary was almost like laid out before we went. So
Of all the places you went, which would you say, I mean, is, dare I say it, is Punjabi cuisine your favorite, or Gujarati, or, I mean, what is your favorite region of food in India?
I think it's unfair to ask that question, because there's,
is it like saying which is your favorite child type question? Yeah,
every region does incredible things, and you know, there are incredible flavors that come out of it. Like, you know, I love Southern Indian cuisine. I love Kerala cuisine. You know, you know, from Hyderabad, who doesn't love, you know, a nice bit of shawarma and you know, haleem, you know? Like, can you tell me anything that's more satisfying than a bowl of haleem, you know, in the winter? No, you can't. But then, you know, I love the lightness and the vibrancy of food from West Bengal, for example. Then you've got the differences in cooking style, you know, from people from Gujarat, and you know, the way that all their sweetmeats and stuff like that. Then all the kebabs from Lucknow. Like, where
does it end? I know it's,
you can't, you can't, and it's very hard. So that's why on our menu you never find it heavy towards a particular region, because everywhere has got so much to offer. It's always a case of like, how do you put it down into 10 courses? Because if we had our way, there'd be about 30, because there's so much to do. Yeah. So that's the thing. So, but yeah, no, I think the food of across India is incredible. You know, and I don't know, in my opinion, I probably know about a tenth of it. I think I'd love to be able to spend, and hopefully once this sorts itself out, I'd want to take my team and travel. Yeah, and start doing that again.
Yeah,
because I've got such a young team.
Yeah, it would be interesting to go with your, you know, everyone's doing these kind of like traveling with my mum, traveling with my dad type. Yeah. It would be interesting, actually, because you learned cooking from your mum, it would probably be really interesting to go with her and make a series out of it, because, you know, you learned your craft from her. She's probably going to be able to have so much input on you in India. I mean, that would be amazing, I think.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what it is. Straight away, I'm thinking, fuck, I won't be able to have, like, after-work drinks. It's going to be boring.
Leave her at the hotel. It's fine. Get to bed early. She'll probably need an early night anyway, after listening to you all day long.
Yeah, I mean, fucking hell. But you're right. But the thing is with my mum, because obviously, growing up in the immigrant community, even now, though, because obviously there's so much more, you know, people from these communities in our country, people have started to almost like stay within their own bubble. When I was growing up, you know, it wasn't like that, because communities, immigrant communities, had people from everywhere. They just had one thing in common, they were immigrants, right? So from various parts of the world, various parts of India. So I look at my mum when we were growing up and the people she associated with and friends and the food we were eating at home, because there were people from everywhere. So we weren't just eating Bengali food at home. So we were eating, you know, Punjabi examples of food that people, you know, one of her friends were Gujarati, so we'd be eating Gujarati food and stuff like that. These are stuff that we were, and we had one of the families that my mother was friendly with, they were Kenyan. So we're eating all these different types of food. So she's got a good understanding of the difference. And she always, like, I go home now and I'll see, if I do pop in to see her, so she'll be on YouTube watching cookery videos.
Brilliant.
Because that has so much more resource.
Yeah.
And I often go and she'll just be watching them back to back to back. And then you'll see, oh, I've made this, I've made that. So she's very receptive to that. And I think that's something that's been quite unique about my mother coming from a Bengali background. Certainly not the case in my peers, you know, the people that I knew back then, or the community that were, you know, growing up in Aston, you know, in the 90s, you know, all the other Bengali homes, they certainly didn't have that approach or that understanding of food.